when China rules, it's a very categorical title. There's no if about it. Why not?
Well, I suppose the short answer is I think this is more likely to happen than not happen. And it certainly also makes a better title.
But you're not just saying that China will rule because it will have the biggest economy.
Oh, no, no, of course. Actually, when China gets the biggest economy, which is not so far ahead, you know, rather less than two decades, then China will definitely not rule the world. It will simply have the largest economy, but not the most sophisticated economy. I mean, it will have the largest economy by virtue of the size of its population. But still, its political and cultural and intellectual and military reach will be very limited. So we're not talking about, you know, a sudden moment when everything will change in the near future. This is a process. It's a longer-term process.
The New York Times' Tom Friedman argued in a column just a few days ago that America still had the chance to beat China because of American inventiveness and American flexibility, if they could rediscover that, he was saying. What do you say to that?
Well, nothing is ever completely cast in stone. There's always the possibility of the relatively unpredictable, so you know things could be different. I'm skeptical of this argument because by the same coin, it also argues that in a sense China isn't and won't be in the future, which is the key, be inventive, and I just don't believe that. I think that, just like we saw with Japan and then the Asian tigers, you know, they start off as essentially catch-up economies that are good at adapting rather than inventing. But over time, as they move up the technological ladder, they become very inventive as they can afford the research and development which a catch-up economy can't.
That was certainly the case of Japan. And back in the 90s, a lot of people were saying about Japan what you're saying about China now.
Well, Japan certainly came to a, in terms of these extraordinary growth rates, certainly came to a, not to a halt, but to a very serious decline in its growth rate with the bursting of the bubble. But Japan was in a very different situation than to China today. The difference being that Japan was already a very advanced and sophisticated economy with a very rich standard of living. China is way off that. I mean, China is still a poor developing society with half the people living in the countryside, which is not to say that Chinese growth rates won't decline. They will in time. They will, because as the catch-up aspect of their growth begins to reduce, then the growth rate will decline. But there's a long way to go before that happens.
I interviewed James Fallows at the Atlantic Monthly recently. He's recently spent 3 years living in China, and I put a version of what you've said to him. He said that China wouldn't reach the kind of position of power that you're talking about for a long time because, he said, people don't want to go and live there. People don't want to migrate there. The pollution, the corruption, the lack of the rule of law and transparency, the lack of a free press, a whole series of things meant that people would not want to go and live there.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, there is something extremely attractive about a very rapidly growing economy, and one which has such a sort of extraordinary cultural heritage as China. I spent a lot of time in Beijing, and I've noticed over the past 2 or 3 years a growing number of overseas Chinese who've come back from the United States or wherever it is often attracted by generous offers, who've gone to live in China again. I've even this summer met quite a few Westerners who, are trying their luck, like the old migrants really from the West in a new land and loving it. Of course, there are all sorts of problems, but I think that China will be a very attractive proposition to a lot of people, depending on their circumstances. Of course, there are all sorts of barriers. I think the biggest barrier, for example, if we're talking about Westerners, is the fact that China, you've got to learn Chinese, really. It's a culture that we're not at all familiar with, so it requires a great effort. I think those are bigger barriers. By the way, the other thing to remember is also that there are large numbers already of Koreans and not so many Japanese, but other people from East Asia who are living and working in China. So I think that process has already started, quite frankly.
Do you believe that the Communist Party can maintain its hold into the next couple of decades and longer?
I think it can, and I think it will. Of course, that the unpredictable may happen, but think of it like this. For 30 years, it's presided over an economic growth rate of 10% or more. That means the economy has doubled every 7 years in size, and the living standards of virtually everyone in the country have been transformed. So actually, the position of the Communist Party as a ruling party has never really been stronger. I mean, if you're responsible for that kind of transformation, your prestige amongst the people is very great. So I don't really see any serious challenge to it over the next two decades, barring, I say, the unpredictable or challenge. You can never be sure about China in this context, but I would expect it to be there for quite a long time to come. And I think if it did get into serious trouble, it would be a bad sign for China as well, because you've got to think, this is a huge country, and how is the political transition going to take place? And it's still, midway through its economic takeoff period. So it's almost certainly going to be a bad time for China, unrest, instability, chaos, and so on. And that would not only be bad for China, it would be bad for the world, because we won't be talking about the Soviet Union in 1989. China is far more important in the world, far bigger than ever the Soviet Union was in 1989.
But as you would know, there are already thousands, literally thousands, of individual localized cases of unrest all over China every year. Can they continue to control that?
Oh, yeah. I as you say, it's been going on for quite a while. I mean, essentially what this is, we've always got to remember what a vast country China is. It's four times the population of the United States, effectively twice the size of Europe. So this is a continent. And it's a continent which is extremely diverse, and which is in varying states of development. So, lots of things happening in China all the time, by definition. We're not talking about something small and local and parochial. Essentially, a lot of these protests have been by farmers who have found their land being taken for development as a result of some kind of deal between local government, not the central government, local government and the developer. I think their grievance is justified. It's been a form of land theft, land seizure in some ways. And they've tried to resist it. And then they go and petition in Beijing and so on. But I don't think that is on its own a source of potential systemic instability, which broadens itself across the country. If you've got a mixture of problems, that coupled with a growing bitterness about inequality, which has, of course, been growing rapidly in China, and a big decline in the growth rate and large numbers of people in the countryside no longer being able to live in the cities and so on. Now, that kind of combination could create much more serious instability, but we're not seeing those conditions at the moment, and we may not.
Do you believe in the growth rate figures that were given by China, even during the recession?
Of course. You know, one of the problems with Western views about China is that there is, over quite a period now, a belief that whatever we're being told or whatever we see isn't true. And there is a lack of
transparency. It's quite difficult to look beyond the surface figures.
Well, as far as those who follow these things are concerned, they believe the figures. And the figure that we've not got no serious reason to doubt the figures. And we can see the transformation in our own eyes, and there's lots of corroborating evidence. I don't think there's any question whatsoever that basically the growth figures are correct. Of course, pulling together statistics across a vast country, which is still poor and so on, is not an easy task. But basically the figures are true.
But you would know that in the case of Japan, going back to that, for instance, there was a period when their decline was masked because they kept production up and they kept exports up, but their profits had really drastically declined. So there was a real difference between output and real growth.
Well, that's a bit different example because, that wasn't what I thought you were implying, which it was that, the figures are a fabrication. In that case, it was simply that the way the Japanese economy was developing was imbalanced in that situation. I think that's a different question.
No, because what happened was that they adjusted their prices to the point where there was no longer any profitability, and eventually...
Well, that's for the export market, yeah. I mean, because Japan was a very export-driven economy.
And are you saying that China is now decoupled? Do you believe that the decoupling has taken place, that it doesn't matter so much whether Walmart buys their stuff?
Oh, no, I don't. I think it still matters. I mean, what we've seen over the past year or so, since the global financial crisis really began to bite, is that China has succeeded, and there were many people who were doubtful whether it could, has succeeded in sustaining a very high rate of growth, over 8%, 8.5%, something like that this year, even though its Western export markets have contracted very considerably. So to that extent, China is not as dependent on Western export markets as many people generally believed it to be. And, of course, whether it could sustain this over a long period, let's imagine the Western recession goes on for several years. Now, could China sustain the kind of fiscal stimulus that it's done this year? They could probably do it for a period, but it might become increasingly difficult. But there is a more general point which you're making, I think, which is the decoupling point, which is that it is clear that China is much more decoupled from the Western economy in terms of its immediate fortunes than it was previously. And that's important, actually, because that's important globally, because what that means is that, as we all know, for several decades, America was really the engine of global growth. And that isn't true in the same way anymore, because America, of course, has been contracting. And China's providing, at least for a significant part of the world, an alternative engine of growth.
Now, on limits to growth, some people say there's a demographic limit, and that will come about because old people in China have always been looked after because there have been big families, and the one child policy means there will no longer be the people to look after the old people, and that's going to cause an enormous social security bill within 20 or fewer years.
They will face a demographic problem. There's no doubt about that. And it will be a serious one. And that will, you know, basically, those of working age will have a rather larger proportion of dependents who are no longer working. Of course, there is a way round it up to a point for the Chinese, which is to abandon the one-child policy, and this is what I think is going to happen. In fact, you know, as a straw in the wind, or more than a straw in the wind, Shanghai earlier in the year announced that it was going to abandon the one-child policy, and I expect other cities and provinces to follow suit, and for the central government to follow suit in due course as well. And I think that a decision to abandon the one-child policy will obviously boost population. I mean, how much it will boost it in the cities? You know, the cities, the one-child policy has always been essentially, has been different in the urban areas from the rural areas. It's been particularly applied to the urban areas. And now a city like Shanghai probably wouldn't have a lot of kids anyway. I mean, I would think you're beginning to look more like Western figures, probably beginning to. But there is something they can do about it, and that is to abandon the one-child policy, and they will.
Finally, if China rules the world, you say when China rules the world, what's that going to mean for the rest of us?
Well, it's going to mean an extremely different world to the one we've grown up in. But of course, it's going to happen over a period of time. And, maybe the young generation now will feel it and see it much more clearly, and their kids than older generations now. But for 200 years, ever since the British Industrial Revolution in 1780, the world has been shaped by the West. First of all, by Europe, and then latterly by the United States. And all the furniture of the global economy and the global polity have been essentially Western designed. And that, we're coming to an end, the end of that era. That's why I talk about the end of the Western world, not the end, demise of the West. Of course, that's not going to happen. But the West will no longer shape in the way that it has. And there will be other countries, not China alone, because we have the rise of India and so on, that China will be the most important. China is going to be the most important, powerful and influential country in the world.
Will it be an imperial power?
Well, it's going to be a hegemonic power. In other words, it's going to enjoy, you know, everyone who talks about the rise of China only talks about economically, but it'll have all sorts of political, cultural, intellectual, you know, military manifestations. It can't just be contained within an economic view, if you say imperial, I doubt personally that China will be an expansionist power in the same way that the West has been. You know, China, for example, has no history of colonial expansion, even though it did have the opportunity to be a colonial power. But it never, for example, colonized Southeast Asia, which it certainly had the overwhelming capacity to do during the Ming and the Qing. But it didn't do that.
It created buffer states.
Well, it had a tributary state.
Tributary
system.
States.
It was the tributary state system. And of course, as a country becomes more powerful in a region, it exercises all forms of power, all sorts of power. So, and China will certainly be like that.
Could Australia end up as a tributary state?
Well, I think the future of Australia is interesting, isn't it? I mean, there it is. Historically, Australia is a result, as we know it today, of European expansion. And it's always considered itself to be a sort of Western country. It thinks of itself as part of the West, even though it's a long way from the West. And we're now moving into a situation where the Western economy is in decline, the United States is in decline, and Australia lies not far off the Asian mainland and close to China. And China is undoubtedly the dynamic economic force in the region, and that position is going to intensify, not decline. And Australia, because it's got the commodities and so on, is being drawn into what I would describe as the Chinese sphere of economic influence. And as a result, Australia is going to change, I think, a lot, and it's going to have to negotiate its position with a rising China in terms of, you know, to what extent, you know, what will be the ramifications and components of that new relationship. It's going to be a very interesting process. I know a lot of Australians will be, to judge by politics over the last two or three decades on these sort of questions, will be very resistant to it. But others will embrace it. I mean, actually, as far as Australia is concerned, it's a tremendous opportunity. Tremendous. Because unlike, say, Europe, which is a long way from China, Australia can enjoy potentially the fruits of Chinese transformation. Some people will lay stress on the dangers and the risks, but you know the opportunities are enormous.
But should we look at those opportunities and, for instance, there's already pressure to relax foreign ownership rules for the benefit of the Chinese? Should we do that in order to make the most of these opportunities, as you say?
Well, Australia will... obviously, these questions are quite difficult issues because, on the one hand, as you correctly point out, you want to maximize your opportunities. On the other hand, you need to keep some kind of control over your economy. I mean, now, during the neoliberal period, for example, in my own country, the philosophy developed that, you know, who owned you, who owned whatever you had, didn't matter anymore. You could have anyone. Of course, I always thought that was, because while it was Western investment, it was acceptable in a way that other forms of investment might not be. But it was, but nonetheless, this was the philosophy. Now, personally, I think this philosophy was taken much too far. So I think that Australia will no doubt strike a balance. I think what would be wrong is for Australia to develop a kind of, discriminatory form of attitude. In other words, it'll accept American investment, but it won't accept Chinese investment. I mean, it needs to have a relatively even-handed approach, but while retaining, a significant amount of control over its own economy, because that's always important.